like to have an Old Testament open at 39, if you care to follow in that way, whatever version it is. The overall truth that comes out of this story with such power is the truth of the providence of God, that if God has put his hand to a plow, or rather to a person, then God continues the work, notwithstanding all the apparent adversities and disappointments and tragedies. And I think in these man-centered days, when all our philosophy is man-centered, it's a tremendous thing to look at a story which has God absolutely at the center, and therefore a story which can give us hope that life can have some meaning then and now. I'm going to divide this chapter 13 into three. It really has three short sections in it, or chapters within it. The first part I'm going to call Triumph. That's when he's in the house of Potiphar, the officer of the guard. Then the next part I'm going to call Temptation, the very famous story of Potiphar's wife, much loved by Hollywood moguls. And then the third part of the story I'm going to call Tragedy, when he's thrown into prison. So what I'm going to do this Sunday is what I tried to do last Sunday, is to let the story speak for itself, to go through it verse by verse to see what it has to say and then how it applies to us. So the first third of the story is Triumph, and you might call it, in perhaps more ordinary jargon, a success story. And we see this young man, who must still have been what the modern world delights to call a teenager, already a successful man in verse 2. And only this week, looking at the council election results, I saw a picture of a young man who looked as though he'd only just left his nappy behind, who is the chairman of the council in Bexley. So if you live there, you better move out quickly. He's only 25, apparently. Astonishingly young age to be so successful in local government. Now here is a young man who can't have been out of his teens, though we don't know exactly his age, who is already successful when he's sold as a slave to Potiphar because of the way in which he does his work. Derek Kidner, to whom I owe a great deal in his commentary, says, I think rather rightly, that the phrase a successful man has a complacent ring about it in modern English. But the thought here is not that Joseph had achieved a great status, but that he had, in fact, contributed considerable achievements in the household, and in that sense was successful. The result of that is that he's promoted, and in verse 4 we find that he has favor in the sight of his master and begins to attend him, presumably as a kind of personal assistant. And he becomes overseer in the house and isn't put in charge of everything. This increases until verse 5 gives us an astonishing picture of a man who so completely has gained the trust of his employer that his employer leaves all that he has in his charge, and having him had no concern for anything but the food which he ate, the point there being that an Egyptian would not touch anything for food that had been prepared by an Israelite or Jew. So apart from that very small caveat, in just a very short time, we're not told how long, this young teenager who'd come into the country as in some ways an unwanted immigrant is already so successful that this distinguished man has made him steward and head of his household. The secret seems to lie in two things according to the telling of the story. Obviously it depends on the human side, on Joseph's ability as well as his humility. He must have been a very able man. He must have had remarkable gifts. I think he must have been humble, because when God blessed him even more, he doesn't become swollen-headed, and success is often a greater test than failure. And he continues in his way of integrity and is consequently promoted. Keeping a portion of your anatomy there, I'd like you to turn swiftly to Colossians chapter 3. You were down at a fair mile this weekend. I've been with a group of professional people, and we've been studying the letter to the Colossians, and we reached this afternoon the remarkable passage about slaves in chapter 3, verse 22. A passage I first remember studying with a group of businessmen in an office in Peltre, which is now actually demolished, but I vividly remember going to this office, and present was a young, very able chartered accountant who'd just recently become a Christian. And we read from verse 22 of chapter 3 to verse 1 of chapter 4 to see the New Testament teaching in Colossians on employees and employers. And we saw how employees are asked to work with all their hearts, wholeheartedly. And we saw how employers are asked to be just and fair. And the New Testament seems to exactly put its needle on the very points that are in need today. And this young Christian man, age about 30, just a young Christian, but a mature chartered accountant, was so excited by this. He'd never seen this kind of New Testament teaching. He had no idea that the Bible hit the bullseye concerning industrial relations today, that he left saying that he was determined to write for the Times. I think I've told some of you this. We all tried to dissuade him, not feeling that the Times editor for letters would be very impressed by being told that the New Testament was really the answer for today, because people just can't believe that. And in fact, I'm sorry, the story doesn't end wonderfully. The letter wasn't published. But it is very striking, this language, spoken to employees who are in a far worse position than any of us could be as slaves, telling them to obey in everything theirs of their earthly masters, not with eye service, not with an eye on the boss's eye, hoping that we shall gain his favor, but simply because we want to please the Lord, doing a wholehearted, fair piece of work. Now that is so rare today, so unheard of, often in industry completely unheard of and very unpopular, that although we may not do it, hoping that the boss will notice, I would dare to say that the boss couldn't possibly fail to notice. And that's exactly what this story says. Verse 3, his master saw that the Lord was with him. It is so remarkable to behave like this in ancient days and in modern days that the master sees. It is known to everybody here that here is a conscientiousness, a wholeheartedness, an integrity, an ability, a humility that is very rare. So on the human side, we're bound to say that. I wanted to say that in order to be fair. But the impression that I've got in reading and rereading this story over and over again is that the author is trying to tell us something rather different than that. He doesn't want to deny that Joseph was an able and humble and conscientious man. But what the author is trying to tell us here, without doubt, is that his success was due to the divine side of the contract. And this is constantly stressed. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. Verse 3, his master saw that the Lord was with him. His master saw that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper. Verse 5, he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house. The blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had. It's repeated again and again and again. What we're told here is that God used this man greatly. God used him greatly. We're going to find, as we look at the story, why God used him greatly, because this very much concerns us if we want God to use us greatly. You've only got one life. You might as well make it worthwhile. And there's no life more worthwhile than the one that God uses. Chapter 41, although I don't want to anticipate what we're going to see on another evening, but I can't bear not just to show you this little trailer of chapter 41. Look at verse 16. When Joseph answers the dreams, or is asked to answer, interpret the dreams, Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. How easy to have taken the credit. No, it's not mine. It's not my ability." Again, verse 28. "It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do." So here is a man as faithful in the Old Testament context as John the Baptist was in the New Testament context, who constantly says, "It is God who has given me the opportunity, God has given me the ability, I owe my success to him." That is one of the secrets, undoubtedly, of being used by God in this world. Now, I want to say something which is very obvious and yet is easily missed. Supposing you went up to a Christian bookstall in St. Helens, and you saw a book called The Man God Uses, or The God Used Man, or A Man God Greatly Used, or A Woman God Greatly Used, I guarantee that you would think it was either a missionary doctor, or a preacher, or some great Christian worker. I think you would. Of course, I've given it away now, haven't I? So you're already saying, no, I wouldn't. But I think, in fact, most of us would feel that if an author wrote on a God-used man, it would be some specialist in spiritual work. But in fact, what we've got here is not exactly a business executive, but, if you like, a household chamberlain, a businessman, a man in the ordinary business of life, not a preacher, not a missionary, not doing special Christian work. He had no lapel in his coat which said, Jehovah Saves. He was not found often rushing down the courtyard to a Bible study group. He wasn't doing spiritual work. He didn't distribute tracts out in the main road. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I don't mind people who distribute tracts. In fact, I admire their courage. I admire the courage of people who have badges which tell us that Jesus saves. But though I admire all these things, I am perfectly sure that all those things are easier in the short and long term than doing a hard-working, consistent, trustworthy job that carries great responsibility. And this is the great shortfall today. It's not very difficult to enthuse Christians to do spiritual work, at any rate for a while, with great enthusiasm. It's obvious that it needs to be done. There's a certain thrill and glamour in doing it. But it's very much harder to get people to undertake, well, yes, spiritual work that goes on steadily, but it's very hard to get Christians today to see, I don't know why, but it is, that to do a job like that, which doesn't entail anything specifically spiritual, is one of the greatest needs we have. And that God is very concerned to use people today in this kind of sphere. We're badly needing, as I understand it, God used men and women in every sphere of life. We're needing them in hospital administration, in the city, in medicine, in every sphere of life. People who get to the top, yes, get to the top, not a wonderful failures, but get to the top, because their very trust in God makes men trust them. Who have got the things that become increasingly rare today, integrity and conscientiousness and willingness to shoulder burdens and responsibility. It was left in his charge. Do you want that? So many people are ducking that today. Now, don't misunderstand me. We need the same qualities in spiritual responsibility as you do in business responsibility, of course. And later on, Joseph takes great spiritual responsibility. But we probably prove to God and to men whether we're capable of taking spiritual responsibility by whether we're willing to do it in the small things of daily life. And the story starts with a teenager who shows that God can trust him, and God uses him, and God gives him great success, and promotes him, his head is not swollen, and God uses him yet more. And already he's becoming a person that everybody knows and talks about. And later God is going to use that. In a sense, verses 1 to 6 is a dress rehearsal, isn't it? For something later on in the story, which the trouble with us is that we know the end of the story, isn't it? We've read the last chapter before we read the first. And we know what a great success he's going to be one day in Pharaoh's palace. But I can't help thinking that verses 1 to 6 is a kind of trailer of that. God is putting him there and saying, now, let's see how you manage. That's my plan for you, there, in a much more exalted station. But I'm going to put you in that very small station first to see how you get on. An awful lot of people who are useless there and hope to be great there. But I think the message of this story is that God is never going to make you any good there unless you're some good here. We shall see that later. Well, that's section 1, chapter 1. A great success, speedily promoted. These attributes and characteristics as rare then as they are now. And even though he's very young, he's promoted. By and large, as I understand life today, age is no barrier. Social class, as it was called, is no barrier. I increasingly feel that those who've got what it takes get very quick promotion. It always grieves me, for example, when I hear young clergy saying, oh, well, we shan't get plum jobs because nobody knows our name, or we went to the wrong theological college, or we didn't get a degree. I believe that all really to be piffle, and faithless piffle at that. If you are a man of whom God uses, It doesn't matter whether you've got the right degree or the right label or the right blood in your veins. God will promote you, and God will use you, and men will be thankful for you. That we learn from Joseph. Now let's hurry on to the central part of the story, which is of great importance and great interest, the temptation. And when you get to verse 6 in ordinary life, you know what happens when you get to verse 6. You've got a speedy promotion. Everything goes well. The sun shines. Each day is better than the last. And what do people say? Can't go on. Can't go on like this. They say, I've been very lucky. I hope it's going to go on. Touch wood. You know, this is how it goes on, isn't it? Now that's, of course, a superstition. The Christian doesn't believe in that. Nevertheless, he knows that this kind of pattern does happen, of great success getting bigger and bigger and then suddenly boom, down and hitting the deck. The Christian knows that this happens not because of superstition and fear, but because there's an enemy. After Jesus was lifted up at his baptism, do you remember, and the Holy Spirit came upon him and a voice from heaven was heard, he must have been wonderfully exalted at that moment, and Matthew tells us that he was sent straight out into the wilderness to battle with the devil. So it is true in life that when God gives us great blessings, the enemy is likely to try to retake some of the country. And this is what happens now. And it all happens because, rather delightfully, we're told in verse 6, Joseph was handsome and good-looking. And so the inevitable happened. His master's wife made eyes at him. She was very blunt. There was no hint. She said to him quite plainly what she wanted. And suddenly, he was faced with a great temptation, which I assume was a real temptation to a young man, and not just a fairy story for our learning. Now, I put down in my notes some things that I feel are as important as anything that I've ever said to you on the subject of temptation. I've never studied the story before, and as I wrote these things down, I very much came to see that these are the very issues at stake in my own life and in your life as a Christian, and I hope that you'll take note of them, because it's really early in life that the great temptations often come, and it's a question of whether we are survivors then that makes all the difference as to whether God is going to use us later on in life. And there's no doubt that early on in life, just as Jesus had his great temptations, there are great temptations, especially to the successful person, where we sort out, or rather where God sorts out, whether he's going to use us. Here is the test, which is in a sense bedrock to the whole of Joseph's life. All the success in the future depended on what he did here. So let's see how he dealt with this temptation. The first thing is that he did what was right and loyal. And I repeat, he did what was right and loyal. Verse 8, he refused and said to his master's wife, "Lo, having me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. He has put everything he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" In other words, he was entirely in control of the circumstances. Now listen to this brilliant comment. Joseph's reasons for refusal were those that another man might have given for yielding. So neutral is the force of circumstance. Let's look at it again. My master has no concern about anything in the house. He is not greater than this house and I am. Those are the circumstances which many people would have used to say, well, since my master is away and isn't concerned and isn't looking, I will give way. Joseph's freedom from supervision and his rapid promotion, which have corrupted other stewards before now, and his realization that one realm only was barred to him, which others from Eve onwards have construed as a frustration, were all arguments to him for loyalty. I find that very challenging indeed, because I've often blamed circumstances, and I've often heard people doing it. And this seems to show quite clearly that God expects us to be in control of circumstances and not underneath them. Let me illustrate from a person who asked my advice some time ago. He was offered a job. It came very suddenly. It was a temptation only in that he had a tacit agreement to remain in his present job for 2 or 3 years. However, the new offer came most insistently, "You must come and see it." The new job had better accommodation and better pay. Obviously, this would be convenient for the family. No doubt there were parents or friends who said, "Take it." Now, that seems to me to be a real temptation. And this person, who is a friend of mine, asked me my opinion. And I said that I did not think that he was at liberty to take it because of the tacit agreement that he had. And furthermore, I said that I thought he ought not even to accept the invitation to go and see it. He ought to refuse and simply say that he was not at liberty to. Now, in the end, for various reasons, he took the job. I personally think it may well have been a mistake. And I very much prayed, as I heard that he'd taken the job, that he would not say, "Circumstances forced me to do it." I don't suppose he has. But we do sometimes use that excuse. These things are constantly coming to us. The temptation comes to better ourselves when we have an understanding with somebody else that we should stay with them. The temptation comes to do something which isn't strictly honest. And Joseph was tempted with something that very definitely wasn't honest, and he did that which was right and loyal. He obeyed his conscience. He didn't parley, he didn't rationalize, he didn't have a discussion group, he didn't set up any inward committee to discuss it with himself. He didn't put it off for 24 hours and say, "I will make up my mind tomorrow." He said, "No, I know that that would be wrong. I want to impress upon you the importance of your conscience. If you've been converted, your conscience has been converted, and you will find that it sends out much clearer signals than it used to do. Learn to obey your conscience. Don't fight with your conscience by trying to proof text your conscience." Some people have gone even as far as doing that. You'll find that your conscience is proof against texts taken out of their context. And you will find that your conscience is proof against comforting thoughts from parents and friends. That's the first rule, then, with temptation in life. He did what was right and loyal to his conscience. Secondly, here's my second rule, which I get from this story. He called the action involved by its true name. Did you see that? "How can I, then, do this great wickedness?" My! You see, he's gone up to the rose bush and he's put a label on it, a rose. Or rather, he's gone up to the thistle and put a label on it, thistle. Let me tell you of a certain Professor Walker Gibson of Massachusetts University. You may not really want to know about Professor Walker Gibson, but you're going to hear about him tonight, because he's got a rather remarkable distinction in the last few months. He's founded a committee. Well, again, that may not strike you as being very novel. But he's the founder committee member of a committee called the Committee on Public Double Speak. And he's publicizing his committee all over the United States following Watergate. And he's listed a number of words that have been used during Watergate, which come under the title of public double speak. The word "illegal" is no longer used, and the word that is used in the documents is "inappropriate." The word "burglary" is no longer used. The word that is used is the word "entry." The word "bugging" is no longer used as being slightly non-new, so the word that is used is "intelligence gathering," so he goes on. And he's collected for his first committee meeting a large number, and given a great deal of publicity to them, of public double speak in the United States. Now, I think it'd be rather interesting to collect some for ourselves. You'll find an enormous amount of it going on today, especially in the popular press, especially from the spokesmen of great power blocks, trade union spokesmen, people like that, people who've got an axe to grind, who've got power and want to justify what other people find rather hard to take. You will find that they also need to know about Professor Walker Gibson and his Committee on Public Double Speak. Now, it's a very great help in life, and I find it a very hard lesson to learn. To learn actually to talk the truth about yourself. What in somebody else's obstinacy in you is tenacity and convictions? Well, you can make them out for yourself. There are many. This man knew very well what he was. It was wickedness. It was not only a sin against his master, but because he had a right view of life, it was a sin against God. because he saw that sins against God were not something spiritual between me and God, but to do with the whole structures of life as I find them and amongst which I live. If he sinned against his master, if he is disobedient to him, it was the same as sinning against God. So he called the act by its right name, and that was a great help because it made truth his ally. You're always a stronger man when you do that. Thirdly, this I thought was very striking when I studied verse 10. Although she spoke to Joseph day by day. Day by day, famous phrase. Well, now let's earth this into our experience. Day after day, the temptation came. I have a friend who comes to breakfast with me sometimes who sells smoked salmon. He always seems to be extraordinarily successful. And I asked him how the three-day week had hit him. And he said, oh, well, they'd very fortunately got a wonderful new contract with BJAM's frozen foods, which had made up the lack of production that they'd lost on other things. And, I said, how'd you do it? Oh, he said, I rang them up pretty well every day. Well, apparently if you want to get a contract with BJAM's frozen foods, that's how you have to do it. You had to go on every day to the manager, or anybody else for that matter. And the devil has learnt this trick from the city. And the devil, therefore... when he wants to win, doesn't just come to you because he knows that you're a pretty strong-minded fellow or girl, and he doesn't just come up to you and say, right, you do this wrong thing, and you say, I've just been to Helen's, of course I'm not going to do that wrong thing. So he says, well, never mind. Be back tomorrow morning. He doesn't tell you that, and he comes back tomorrow morning, and then he's back on Tuesday, back on Wednesday. Now that has been a proof, and a very profound proof, of where a man's loyalty lies more often than once, but we'll look at the once. Judges chapter 14, verse 17. And you'll remember who we're talking about. Here's the strong man of the Bible, proving that you can be very strong and tough outwardly, but very weak inwardly. Well, I don't think he was weak inwardly to begin with. And he could resist these women who he invited too easily into his life. He could resist them at first, but it was always difficult, wasn't it, day after day. Verse 17. She wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Over the page to chapter 16, verse 10. Behold, you have mocked me, said Delilah to Samson, and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound. And he told her. Verse 13, until now you have mocked me. Tell me how you might be bound. And he said to her, etc. And so she goes on. How can you say, verse 15, I love you? And so she goes on and on and on. Verse 16, and when she pressed him hard with her words, day after day. Now, I must confess that I have found that far the most searching test that temptation has to bring to us, not least the temptations that we're thinking about in this particular chapter. The temptations that come to us that are sudden are not really very difficult to resist, but those that come to us steadily, persistently, refusing to go away, these, I think, are sometimes very difficult to deal with. Conversely, incidentally, we're told in the New Testament, day by day to provoke our friends to good works, lest they should backslide, which is a very interesting balance, isn't it? If the devil comes day by day knocking on the door, Christians should day by day be encouraging one another. So Joseph stands there day by day faced with this problem. It can't have been any easier the second or the third or the fourth time. And sometimes there is a tendency to say, well, I can't stand up against this any longer. But he did. He withstood constant pressure. Fourthly, he wisely kept his distance from temptation. Verse 10, clause C. He would not listen to her, to lie with her, or to be with her. I'm quite sure she changed her tune, don't you? She said, look here, it's the cup final this afternoon. Do come sit with me. I'm not after anything else now, but why not come sit with me? Or she said to him, look, I think I'd like to come down with you to choose the curtains this time. A woman's eye might be a good thing. But he said, no, thanks very much. I'm going shopping on my own. Sorry to give you a lot of cross-references today. It's time, though, we got to know the Bible. It's always embarrassing when a master of a city company comes to read the Bible and the place and hasn't been found, and he looks at Genesis and the New Testament. So in order that you shouldn't get into that position, Proverbs chapter 5, verse 1. Find our way through the scriptures. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion, that your lips may guard knowledge. For the lips of a loose woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps follow the path to Sheol. She does not take heed to the path of life. Her ways wander, and she does not know it. And now, O sons, listen to me. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. Don't read the literature that she distributes. Don't go to the shows that she enjoys, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the merciless, lest strangers take their fill of your strength and your labors go to the house of an alien. And at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and body are consumed. Medics take note, because they know that verse 11 is true very often. What an appalling thing to come to the end of your life and realize it's all been wasted for that. That might have happened to Joseph, but wisely he kept her at a distance. And then the fifth rule in temptation of this kind, because it's a temptation that is very real to young people today, he fled from sin. Verse 13. She caught him by the garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. One more reference, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22. And actually, the Revised Standard Version, I think, slightly spoils the old Authorized Version, which I think I'm right in remembering has got fly or flee here in verse 22. So shun or fly from youthful passions, and aim, and the Greek word is much stronger, pursue righteousness. What Paul is saying there is be wholehearted in it. Run away from youthful passions that are wrong, and run after righteousness, faith, love, and peace. Be flat out for both. Flat out against the one, flat out running against the other. So sometimes we're called to be, in that sense, cowards, to keep our honor by running away. We need to take drastic action, as Christ said, to pluck out the eye, lest it cast us into hell. Let me read those five, if you're taking notes or if you've got a good memory. He did what was right and loyal. In other words, he obeyed his conscience immediately. He called the act by its true name, wickedness, and not weakness. He withstood constant pressure. Day by day, he remained in the Lord's strength. For he wisely kept away from temptation. He kept it at a distance. Five, he fled from it when the moment came. He took drastic action. Even though he lost his prospects, he didn't lose his honor. Chapter 3 starts at verse 19. We know the rest of the story in the household, how she makes up this appalling lie. But of course, a woman who can't be trusted in one thing can't be trusted in another. A girl who gives herself away easily will be untrustworthy in most other things in life. Verse 19. When his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, this is the way your servant treated me, his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. What a bitter end to the story. The old Jewish commentators used to say that the punishment for this kind of thing was death, and they could only imagine that he didn't get death because Potiphar had some suspicions about the trustworthiness of his wife. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but don't let's imagine that this was much less painful, for in Psalm 105, don't bother to turn to it, but listen to what the psalmist says looking back. He sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron, until what he had said came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. That's the psalmist's reminiscence, Psalm 105, verse 18. A very striking reminiscence of those days in prison. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron. Now, what was the benefit of all this? Of course, we know there are going to be great benefits because we know the wonderful end of the story. But as it was for Joseph, if you use your imagination and forget that you know the end of the story, it must have been a bitter thing. He can look back with joy to being in that pit to which his brothers threw him, and God, in a sense, lifting him out and then bringing him to this very happy position and promoting him and giving him honor and glory. And now the whole thing goes back again, and he's back in prison with absolutely no future, because the kind of prison sentence here is the kind that you get in certain countries today where you've been put in without trial, and therefore you're likely to stay there for good. There was no Amnesty International or anybody else to write on Joseph's behalf. There are some days, aren't there, in everybody's life, not many, thank God. I actually can't remember one in my life just at the moment, but we all have them from time to time when we really do at last seem to be facing an absolutely blank and black wall. And there really doesn't seem to be any hope. Perhaps somebody in whom we've trusted has left us, or perhaps something has happened that has taken really the bottom of our world away. And that's what it must have been for Joseph. I just want, as I finish, to show you, however, that God brought from it tremendous riches. First, it was here in the prison, verse 21, that he experienced for the first time in all its depth God's steadfast love. I'm glad the Revised Standard Version translates that little word and phrase so well, not just mercy or grace, but steadfast love. This is the part of God's character that means most to the Christian. The fact that when we are faithless, God is not. That when we are down, God comes down to our position and shows us steadfast love. So that sometimes we have to be knocked off our perch, and sometimes we have to come right down, perhaps in physical health, or perhaps in losing a job, or perhaps in some other great disappointment. And it's down at the bottom of that pit that we discover for the first time the steadfastness of the love of God. So it is always true that only those who have wept know his comfort. Only those who have been really lonely know his friendship. Only those who have been really down at the bottom know how deep God will bend to reach us. So that's the first thing. He experienced God's steadfast love. Secondly, he gained favor from the Lord in most unfavorable circumstances. One of the books, plus a pot and baby powder and various other extraordinary things that I found on my desk when I got back this afternoon from all the young ladies who inhabit my desk in the morning. One of them was a nursery rhyme book. I've just been reading Three Blind Mice ever again. And you know, when you read these extraordinary rhymes, something sticks in your mind, and the one that stuck in my mind walking up the aisle this evening was, "Did you ever see such a thing in your life?" Well, now, if it isn't going from the absolutely ridiculous to the sublime, did you ever see such a thing in your life as verse 22? Have you ever heard of someone thrown into prison who becomes the chief warder? The keeper of the prison was so impressed with him that he committed to Joseph's care all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever was done there, he was the doer of it. Now, it seems to me this is one of the most important parts of the story, that what he'd been in Joseph's house, he was in the prison. And what he was in the prison, he's going to be one day in the palace. That what he was in Potiphar's house, he was in the prison. when he was a prisoner. And what he was as a prisoner, he was going to be when he was a governor. The same qualities that made him a model prisoner made him a model governor. Perhaps worth mulling that one over. The same qualities that made him in the prison someone whom everybody could trust made him in the palace later on someone everybody could trust. So let's kill forever this lie of the devil's that everything will be different from us once God takes us out of our narrow position and gives us a much wider place in which to show our talents. The archdeacon was just talking to me some time ago about certain clergy who said that if only they could have much better plant in their churches, they could really get somewhere. You know, that's a lie. You don't need better plant to get somewhere. If you get somewhere, probably then the result will be a better plant. And if Christian workers can be misled, I think most people can. There are many, many people who think, I could do his job. I can't do mine. That's patently obvious to everybody. But when God gives me a wider place and a better job and a future opportunity, then I'm going to be great. Now, this is one of the most unpopular lessons of life, but we've got to face it. Here it is in this paragraph. What you are today as a nobody is exactly the same kind of person you will be when you're a somebody. So if you're a miserable nobody, then God help people when you're a miserable somebody. So if I can gain the favor of the Lord, and if I can prove the Lord in prison, if I can prove the Lord when I'm a student nurse and the sister's cursing my head off, I don't think sisters do that nowadays, but sometimes I suppose they do. If I can prove the Lord when I'm just beginning in Christian work, if I can prove the Lord in those times, then I shall be able to prove the Lord when I've got responsibility and my name is known. So that's a very great lesson that Joseph and we all learn from this. And then the third great lesson that he learned here, that we learn from this. First, God's steadfast love is to be found there just as everywhere else, and perhaps more so. Secondly, God wants us to prove him in the depths so that he can take us to the heights. And thirdly, he learns that he was in the line, well, he learned later at any rate, that he was in the line of God's purposes despite all appearances. All appearances against him. You can just imagine what it was like in those days. Everybody was saying he was a bad lot. You know how the gossip sort of gone on. They say he was absolutely marvellous, you know, when he was Potiphar's house. I was at a bridge party with Mrs. Potiphar, and she said he was well, she wouldn't, of course, would she? Sorry. Somebody else said he was amazing. And then somebody else, lighting their cigarette, would say, well, you know, there's no smoke without a fire. And probably he was a bad lot. And perhaps Joseph felt that God was taking a day off and that surely God's power had somehow let him down. He just couldn't understand it. And perhaps even Joseph might have been tempted to say, well, God used me to show Potiphar what a great God he is, and now surely all my testimony has been destroyed. It must have been very difficult. And yet what a wonderful thing for us to know and for Joseph to begin to grasp over those months and even years in prison, that he was exactly in the line of God's will. I'm going to give you one cross-reference as I finish to show that in an even greater man, Paul the Apostle, Philippians chapter 1, another man who was often in prison and wrote some of his greatest letters from prison. Didn't sit in prison dreaming of that beautiful study he was going to build in Athens when he got back there, when he had all those books at his disposal. He wrote letters when he was in prison. God is still using those letters today. Quite amazing. When he was cast into prison, all the other Christians used to get rather worried. Verse 12, Philippians 1. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. So it has become known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. I suppose Paul had never had such a wonderful opportunity to give pastoral advice over a long period, because for 2 or 4 hours at a time a guard was chained to his arm and couldn't get away. Long and searching must have been the exhortations and teaching that those guards got, so it became known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard what the gospel was. And when it filtered out outside the prison gates that the most victorious man in the prison was this prisoner, Paul, most of the brothers outside became much more confident in their freedom to speak. Isn't that a good bit of psychology? When they saw that he could do it there, they felt, well, we ought to be able to do it here. Well, let me just finish by saying two things about this story, this chapter, and then we're closed. I think that I felt as I finished this chapter that it is an exciting thing to live with God. I remember hearing a youth speaker say this at Spree, and I wasn't very sure that I agreed with him in the way he put it. He got up and he said, "Now, everybody, it's the most exciting thing to be a Christian." And I felt, well, there are quite...